Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks' The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. I'll be your host as we go through Chapter 3, or Section 3, from 3.1 to 3.9, which is all of it, of James Mason's Siege, a book composed of sections taken from his newsletters published in the early-mid-80s. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and ultimately archived at alexlinder.com. Let's dig in. Section 3 is called National Socialism. Let's see. Picks up on page 124. Begins with three epigraphs from Hitler, George Lincoln Rockwell, Alfred Rosenberg, and Joseph Goebbels. Four, actually. He who wants to live must fight. Therefore, he who does not want to live in this world of eternal struggle does not deserve to be alive. Adolf Hitler said that. We are the new barbarians. Barbarians in quotes. Forged in iron hardness in the fires of their hate and persecution. All over the world, we wait to pounce. And even our present acres of death, will someday bloom again. Alfred Rosenberg. Notice that not all Bergs, or names ending in Berg, or even the name Rosenberg, are Jews. And I believe Rosenberg was somewhat different from the other Nazis in that he had direct experience of the communist. He came from one of those little Baltic countries, I believe, originally. Finally, last epigraph. We shall reach our goal when we have the power to laugh as we destroy, as we smash, whatever was sacred to us as tradition, as education, as human affection. Joseph Goebbels, who was a doctor. 3.1. National Socialism. We agree that unless something equal or better exists with which to replace something, it is damn best to leave it alone. We feel it would be a mistake, a retreat, to return to the dim, distant past for an answer, though I agree we must rediscover our ancient heritage as there is much to be learned from it. Another reason for not seeking an, quote, alternative religion in the classic sense is because it is utterly foolish to postulate anything one cannot see, touch, and examine. Just as the Aryan race is the highest order of being yet produced by nature on this planet, so too is National Socialism the highest, most sophisticated, and advanced creed, yet formulated by the white man for his own betterment. Nothing more than that today exists. Nothing more is required. It represents all of our needs. The message of siege is not a negative one. It is, however, important, and that is why we cannot afford any longer the stupid mistake of mixing or confusing our goals and priorities like so many traditional right-wing types have done in the past. The slogan, For God, Race, and Nation, is an example. We cannot allow any foreign, alien moral code or dogma to cramp our revolutionary style, and, when the big cleanup begins, no criminal will enjoy any hands-off privilege just because he may be some religious master of hocus-pocus or mumbo-jumbo. Our march toward revolution will not be blocked by any rules of the establishment, and our revolutionary new order will be absolutely free of any trace whatsoever of the old. That was Volume 10, Number 7, July 1981. 3.2, The German Mystique. Since this writer has not a drop of German blood in his veins, it gives me good qualifications to write in the following issue. So fundamental is it to what we're doing, and the way we're doing it, that without fail it hits us squarely in the face each time we are either attacked by the ignorant, or are approached by the unfamiliar for membership, etc. Unless we ourselves come to understand it fully, we can hardly hope to convey the proper impression of it to the people we are out to win. Detractors will attack us as krauts, somehow agents for a foreign power, While a great many sheepish sympathizers will open with lines like, "Do you have to be German to join your group?" Generations of war hysteria propagated by Hollywood, anyone who uses the swastika must be German, or so they imagine, part of the kernel of ignorance and misinformation which hurts our people to this very day. Neither Marx nor Stalin were Russians. Napoleon Bonaparte was not French. Jesus of Nazareth was neither a Jew nor a Christian. National Socialists in America today are not Germans. National Socialism is a philosophy first codified and brought to power by Adolf Hitler in Germany. Today, a Catholic need not be an Italian simply because it was in Italy that his religion first became the official one of the state. Philosophies and philosophers, or prophets, are largely interchangeable within the framework of our blood. The most recent, and certainly the greatest yet to appear in the world, happened to materialize first in Germany. Any philosophy must adapt itself to a large degree to the customs and traditions of the people among which its proselytes must move and work. The Christians are undoubtedly the greatest masters of that art to date. Having stolen or latched onto the most important pagan holidays, they came to dominate the entire white world as Christendom. As successful as these extreme tactics were for the Christians, I can hardly visualize our bending the birth date of Hitler to match some existing popular feast day. But then, what is the importance of a date on a calendar as compared to power over men's minds and souls? Souls in quote. Quotes. Hitler made the philosophy work for his people in the context of the time and place, and, in turn, the philosophy made the people greater. Hitler made National Socialism in Germany the epitome of everything German, and, by that, he was the first, and thus far the only man, to forge a truly united Germany. Even the Kaisers had been unable to fully accomplish this. By making some superficial concessions to the everyday whims of the people, Hitler's philosophy, together with its greater meaning, was able to, quote, creep up painlessly on the common man in his simplicity, who otherwise could have been expected to rebel against such sudden changes in his world and in his picture of things. Hitler was the world's first truly peaceful revolution. Such a superhuman job was done by Hitler and his German National Socialists in the 25-year history of the NSDAP that the image has stuck and probably always shall stick. This is in no way a bad thing. Without it today, the white race, and particularly the very young, would have no means to any knowledge at all of the greatness of their people in the recent past, or the brilliant promise ahead if we are only able to gain white unity. All of the white nations of the earth, from antiquity to the recent past, possess the most magnificent histories, customs, and traditions of their own equal to the best that Germany has. All branches of the white race have great cause to be proud in their own heritage, so long as that great heritage is made known to them. The deriders of Germany and the authors of Quickie World History for the Busy Man love to harp away on Germany's two sensational tries at conquering the world. People remember this sort of thing, as there is nothing else around quite to compare with it. It captures the imagination. The plain truth no one is interested in is that not only was world enslavement never even contemplated by the Germans, it was never within their capability. European unity, dominated and maintained by Europe's heartland, was the furthest goal at any time. The Coca-Cola culture isn't told that the nation having come the closest to complete world domination was England, who by the turn of the last century held 1/4 of the surface of the world's continents and controlled the oceans in between. In spite, Germany gets the blame, the credit/blame, but the important thing is that at least there stands the example of the white man's incomparable, irresistible military prowess in glaring, almost incomprehensible contrast to, quote, democratic actions in Korea, Vietnam, and lately Iran. Inextricably intertwined with this is the charge of the liberals about, quote, German militarism. Victorious nations have historically taken turnabout at setting the military style and pace for the other leading armies of the world. Prior to 1871, the pace setter was France. One needs only to glimpse at the design of uniforms on both sides of the U.S. Civil War for confirmation. After 1871, it was the turn of Germany, and spiked helmets appeared in the United States, England, and Russia. The, quote, German goosestep was and still is utilized in East Europe, Russia, and large parts of South America. The unique German Stahlhelm is still today worn by armies in such places as Spain, Egypt, and again throughout South America. One place neither the goosestep nor the Stahlhelm is practiced or worn is West Germany. Yet without Nazi Germany catching hell today, these fine examples would be unknown to Aryan youth. The liberal pacifists and humanitarians, with their momentary power of the press and dollar, hate all symbols of strength and masculinity, and they therefore seize upon all the strongest, most outstanding of these very things and hold them up to ridicule. And that nation which has most lately demonstrated the greatest strength of masculine willpower and self-assertion, without which not much is ever accomplished, gets the full, quote, treatment from these impotent liberal democratic types. When those of our own revisionist historians claim that Germany was a crucifixion, they are right. But if this is a cross we as National Socialists in America today must bear, we do so willingly. As much as by all this name-calling on the part of philosophical and intellectual pansies, also by the fact that the great German tradition is now locked forever in time, unchanged and unchangeable, does all of this stand out to the lost white masses of today as peculiarly German and not generally white or Aryan? National Socialist Germany went down in a blaze of glory, and it will forever be remembered that way. All of the other nations of the West, those that, quote, won the war, have died or are now dying slow, painful, lingering deaths as they are infected and eaten alive by liberal democracy and Jews. When one thinks of a German, one envisions a helmeted, goose-stepping stormtrooper. When one thinks of an American, a Briton, or a Frenchman, he sees only a degenerated beat, pot-blowing slob, one indistinguishable from the other. They don't know that 40 years ago, every American, Englishman, or Frenchman was as disciplined, squared away, and patriotic as any German of that day. Neither do they grasp that, in West Germany today, the people are for the most part as liberalized and degenerate as the worst in America. It's all a matter of imagery. If we are called, quote, Germans because we have as our ideal all the very best traditions of the white man, then I suppose that's as good and convenient a name as any other. The same people would stand back in disbelief when informed that Hitler designed the Stormtrooper uniform, patterning it largely after the British World War I model, originally designed by one Sam Brown for service in British India. There's nothing wrong in taking pride in one's German ancestry, or mentioning with a pride a proportion of German blood in one's veins, but we are still faced today with one of our enemy's more deadly fabricated lies designed to throw a split within the white race, that Hitler, the Germans, and National Socialism in general regard the other branches of the white race as Untermenschen. Germany never had anything to compare with the British slogan that the niggers begin at Calais. Or often, the wogs begin at Calais. Calais is the French town that's right across from Britain. It's closest to it, 22 miles away, I think. If anything cost Germany the last World War, it was the number of narrow-minded, chauvinistic bureaucrats who did stupidly feel and operate this way. But they are found in every nation and have a lot to do with the ease which the deceitful Jews have been able to get the white man killing one another in the past. But it wasn't part of Hitler's program, and it isn't part of ours. Another danger is fantasizing that the situation today is that of Germany in the 1920s and 30s, and we must somehow find or create a, quote, Führer, that we should act the part of Hollywood Nazis, in short, that we can expect to do an exact replay of 1933 here in the United States. It is a danger because it just won't work. In Southern Europe, Christianity came to power slowly, via more subtle means, while in Northern Europe it was brought to power largely by the use of the sword. Many of the rites, etc., remained the same, but the methodology was vastly different and was suited to do the job at hand in the setting that existed. We, Thanks to Adolf Hitler and his great German compatriots, also have our rites, rituals, and holy days on this calendar, and I expect they'll not change. Hitler and his movement in Germany have given us traditions, martyrs to honor, and great battles to commemorate, but it does not mean that we should try to live in the past, or be that which we are not. The Christian Church has its age-old customs, but they do not go around as Jesus did 2,000 years ago in beard, robe, and sandals, trying to walk on water. Those that do are written off as nuts, a thing which we must avoid at all cost, or they're eaten by crocodiles, as one recent African Christian who tried to walk on water. "But I don't understand," another said. "He prayed and fasted all week." Yet we do have a valuable and powerful weapon to use in that, whereas our enemy has been able to gradually do away with much of the rich heritage and thereby identity of the nations of the West, they, by their very paranoid hatred of Germany, have actually preserved for us all the very finest of the white man's way of life. Mention Nazi and you think of German. Mention German and you think of an ordered, strong, and healthy way of life. You think of a people who are united and proud of their race and able to accomplish things together in a big way. Commander Rockwell bet everything on the theory that, when the white man got sick and tired of the alien hothouse atmosphere artificially created by the Jews, he'd instinctively know where to expect the opposite, which will always be represented by no one but us. So when a good white brother or sister comes up to you with a rather timid and awkward question as to whether he or she must be German to be part of this movement, don't deny the great German contribution to Western civilization, but rather point out to them that, if you are white, you belong with us, and emphasize that you're either white or you are not. That was Volume 10, Number 2, February 1981. 3.3. The Chain. Getting down to the most common denominator is the only way to achieve ideological coherence and unity. Race is, of course, the most basic element. But to put it and leave it at that can confuse as many as it enlightens. Are we mere, quote, racists? Hardly. The best explanation I've yet found for that is also the best illustration of what all facets of the movement may come to agree unanimously upon and, from that point, eventually submerge any remaining petty differences. With the religionist at one end of the movement and the atheist at the other, total agreement can still be reached on this one point, the chain. Whether beginning with evolution or some kind of divine creation, the chain represents the endless journey of the generations of the white man through the countless centuries of time. And we are all out to see that the chain remains unbroken. Like the earth and the universe itself, it is eternal and, if anything is sacred, this certainly is. It's referred to as a chain because at any given point in time, that particular generation is a link with certain obligation and duty to both past and future. Behind us, we can see the chain stretching backward into infinity, and ahead of us, forward toward an even greater infinity. We may well be living in a terrible time, terrible for us, but it only means that the responsibility and the care for the chain that we are now charged with is at its most critical point, perhaps more so than at any other time. As a basis for political motivation, as well as religious conviction, it serves well. There is all the identity, purpose, meaning, and birthright, as well as duty, that anyone could ever hope for. And it is quite real, not pie in the sky or some abstract form of moralistic dogma. A lot of lost people would be found if this philosophy would become universal. This is the cornerstone because nothing could be more basic, and yet nothing could be any higher. The system and its two great halves, capitalism and communism, have as their ultimate goal its final destruction. And there is testimony enough to its reality, as well as our own concept of good and evil. That was Volume 14, Number 6, June 1985. 3.4. Consequences, not conscience. This is a question of responsibility versus superstition. The elders who set down the religious tracts back before time had it in mind to preserve the people and the culture by a series of do's and don'ts. The mistake they made rather than to take the time to explain in these tracks why, was to cut corners and attach the, quote, supernatural element in order to give their man-made laws more clout. Many of these laws make perfectly good sense, but yet today have been totally undone, twisted, and perverted because the elders failed to state the why and wherefore behind them. They left it as a matter of a person going to an intangible paradise or damnation, depending on how well he kept to the laws. It was a simple enough matter for outsiders to cast the least little doubt about these hereafters into the minds of the recently educated masses to effectively destroy the potency of the entire teaching, so-called enlightenment. Like telling a child that unless he eats his vegetables, the boogeyman will get him, this approach does justice to neither the merit of eating one's vegetables or to the intelligence of the child himself. Besides, when, sooner or later, the child becomes aware that there exists no boogeyman, after all, the elder or parent begins to look like a fool and a liar. This is the general appearance that organized religion has taken on. It's often been said that, unless you can present something superior or at least equal to that which already exists, best leave well enough alone. We, as National Socialists, do in fact have something far superior to these churches that are to be found everywhere throughout the Western world, on both sides of the Iron Curtain. We feel it is overdue to break away from leftover moral codes and religious dogma of the Dark Ages and enter a true age of enlightenment, both genetically and physically. We believe, quite simply, that a foolish, selfish, or immoral act can be expected to bring its consequences tomorrow. Liberal types, with only a thin veneer of religiosity, believe they can get away with any behavior today, show up in church next Sunday, and worry about it in some hereafter, which in any event their gut tells them isn't there. It is for themselves only that they live. It is to hell with even their own children and the world they shall have to live in. So what then to all of this if it is the spirit in the next world that is all that matters? And as for the professional do-gooders, they are out for nothing more than to rack up points for themselves in this same hereafter. They pervertedly view human existence either as a veil of tears or as a testing ground where some personal god sends souls to measure their merit to exist in some afterlife. National Socialists, on the other hand, view life, personal experience, as representing a link in a chain existing back into the limitless past and forward into the limitless future. In you live all of your ancestors that have ever lived since the dawn of evolution, and in your children and children's children, so you shall live for the rest of eternity. The responsibility in this is a grave one. Each has it in his hands or her hands to break the chain, either by not reproducing at all, or by reproducing with other than one's kind. And it is with this awesome responsibility in mind that all our behavior as National Socialists is based. Will my action this day, this moment, advance or retard the good of the race? Not whether one stands to own a mansion in the sky if one goes against all his natural instinct and accepts something totally alien as his neighbor or his kin, not fear of some personal god, but obeyance to duty within oneself and respect to oneself is what commands the actions of National Socialists. What greater curse could there be than bringing into being, or existing as, a racial anomaly with no identity, no past, and no future? Short-term foolishness we ourselves must live with. Long-term idiocy posterity must live with. And how will it view us for our actions today? As opposed to Christianity, our Viking ancestors believed in luck. They also knew that one made one's luck by living and acting honorably, wisely, and prudently. These modern-day ministers and the whole popular attitude has it that you can do any damn thing you feel like doing, as long as it doesn't hurt the other person, they say, and the Lord will forgive. These millions of people are indeed making their own luck as well. So while more and more churches are being built, the moral tone of the country sinks ever deeper into the morass. What a lucky nation we are becoming. Those National Socialists who don't need the leverage of heaven and hell, don't need to be frightened or induced into any pattern of behavior, but who have it in themselves to think and act in an honorable way, independently, it will be those who take command of the future, if there is to be one. That's Volume 12, Number 4, April 1983. "3.5 Marching to One Drummer." One of the biggest differences between National Socialism and the rest of the rightist spectrum, aside from ideological, strategic, and tactical differences, is the nature of the intended state to be once the system is collapsed and destroyed. We are, of course, not talking about immediately after the fall of the system, when it will be largely up for grabs, but well after the smoke is settled, once new sense and order has been established. We have definite ideas, the same ones we've always had. Observation, plus the folkways of our own people, have taught us that there is but one way to go. It would be well it get understood now. The Posse Comitatus, of course, favor government at the county level, while the NSRP, National States Rights Party, and those similar types favor it at the state level. Most rightist reactionaries have as part of their platform the belief and the statement that, quote, big government is an evil by itself and has to be done away with. Neo-Republicans and Neo-Democrats alike are of the conviction that the purpose of government is merely to serve as caretaker over affairs of business, property, and defense. We disagree with them all. Commander Rockwell stated that the question is not now one of how much government, but of how good a government. Hitler was clear in Mein Kampf, just as he was clear in Triumph of the Will, that it was always his intent, and the intention of the whole NSDAP, to be the one and only source of power and authority in Germany. We intend the same here in North America. We hold no illusions that this march to power will not be long and hard. We still have a strong and powerful enemy system firmly in place before us that has to be removed by one means or another. Once accomplished, there are the myriad factions that will then, by vying for power over this continent and the rest of the world, foreign and domestic rivals for control will have to be met and dealt with. At the end, there will be the factions within the movement itself that will have to be united into a single unit under a single authority. It may sound crazy, diversionary, or impossible, but it is a primary pillar of NS philosophy. It is the drive for power. It is the will to power. If all the other problems around us were to disappear tomorrow, we, as National Socialist Revolutionaries, would still have this will to power to be fulfilled and would continue on our course. In our view, the function of government is as the leader of its people, not merely caretaker or arbiter. Hitler said that the leading forces make the society and the nation what it is and what it will become. This means taking the youth firmly in hand, raising them up in the manner that our ideology commands, so as to achieve the ever more perfect race and state in the shortest possible time. Only a centralized government can accomplish this. So-called rights and freedom all take distant backseats to this highest goal. The task must be accomplished without petty interference from any quarter. Aside from future considerations, if in the present day the movement could somehow find the wisdom and maturity to discipline itself into functioning as a single unit, then it would be in short order one hell of a long way ahead. The white man's greatest strength in the past has been his genius for organization. His greatest weakness has always been his tendency to contrariness and disunity. It has to be overcome and broken. The word that will sooner or later pop up is dictatorship. We favor dictatorship. Our own. Commander Rockwell again said in counter-response to protests of limperists and liberals against heavy-handed governmental policies, primarily in foreign lands, that it is not a matter of dictatorship, but only whether it is our dictatorship or not. And Hitler said, regarding the prevalent ignorant concept of dictatorship as being a one-man show, that the very idea was absurd, that it requires a very large and dynamic team effort to run the affairs of a great nation in modern times. We are here speaking of one team, not dozens of teams all getting in one another's way. Make no mistake, this country today is ruled by a dictatorship, that of Big Brother. What we plan is as far removed from this as it is possible to get. Yet ours will be a dictatorship also. It will be such because we have no tolerance whatever for opposition of any kind, even ineffectual opposition, as it is certain that this smug omission on the part of Big Brother provides the seed that will kill him ultimately. Big Brother's dictatorship is faceless, nameless, and alien to the great majority of people it rules over. Furthermore, Big Brother's rule as designed is blatantly outspoken about, and is having the results of being clearly against the best interest of all of the people over which it rules, all save but one small group, the system's own ruling pigs. So you should be able to see that there are at least good dictatorships and bad dictatorships. The coming rule will be one of and with its own people. It will be strictly manned and operated by men of the people, with their one goal being the furtherance and the betterment, the increased greatness of their people. Considerations such as governmental, financial, or international matters will be but sidelines to be used or discarded according to whether or not their application, in any case, will favorably or adversely affect the white race. And it will be because of this complete dedication to the interests of the race that no interference will be allowed. Big Brother is absolutely bent upon the destruction of distinct races, and most of us know to what lengths he has already gone to see to it that his plan is not altered in any way. We must be at least as determined as he is, at least that and more so. That's Volume 13, Number 2, February 1984. 3.6. No thanks to the Jews. It has been said in some places that the spirit of Adolf Hitler has been kept alive by his enemies, the Jews. I say this is patently false. Commander Rockwell said that the Jews would build their own gas chambers if the price was right. And so the Jews keep the Hitler mania going because it is highly profitable for them to do so. There are so many tenets of the National Socialist State incorporated into the State of Israel that it is positively striking. The Jews wish intently that Hitler had been theirs, in fact, had been one of their own, and this all-consuming fascination will remain irresistible to them. The Jews, being masters of psychological technique, understand better than most the effectiveness of the boogeyman stratagem. By holding up a Nazi threat, even though through their media, they keep their own little Jews in line. They keep the dumb goyim groveling, and they also keep us, or many of us, barking up the wrong Hollywood tree. Then, too, there is the fear angle. The Jews have no other real choice than to continue trying to keep Hitler alive, but on their terms, as a monster. The absurd notion that Hitler would fade out of the picture should the Jews suddenly decide to turn their back on him holds no water, for the Jews themselves are well aware of the situation. Should they leave his memory alone, his spirit would not fade, but rather the truth, however gradually, would come to fill the vacuum left by the cessation of their lies. In point of fact, the Jews are trapped by Hitler. It is indeed ironic, but no thanks are due to the Jews. Volume 12, Number 9, September 1983. 3.7. The most deadly misconception we face. Of course, the view that the common man has of our movement is so screwed up it's pathetic. Yet in the end, it will still come down to our being uncompromisingly pro-white, anti-Jew, anti-black, and the revolutionary symbol of the swastika will yet prove our greatest blessing. But there is one, just one, widely held misconception that we must work to dispel in the minds of those we may need later on. It is neither one of the two most common ones, first, that we supposedly gassed 6 million Jews, and second, that we are somehow communists. The whining about concentration camps is a peacetime, parlor room luxury which will fade fast when hell breaks loose, and people are looking for killers to be on their own side. What better credentials could we possibly have? The absolute stone-headed rednecks keep on with the Nazism equals communism because that's the way they view all authoritarianism. However, most of these folks know how to hold a rifle and will be recruited to our side fast when General Hell breaks its tissue paper bonds. You might guess all night and still not come up with the misconception I'm speaking of. While our biggest opponents, the Reds, love to keep using the 6 million complaint, you will at least notice that they don't refer to us as communists. How silly it would be to call us the very thing that they themselves are. They instead call us fascist, which is only mildly irritating. But other than that, those who have the most to fear from us, and who like to make their name-calling campaigns count, claim that we are the last resort of entrenched capitalism. And if too many white workers believe that, we've got problems. Like the 6 million canard, it stems from the National Socialist experience in Germany. The fact is that most of the German people were healthy in mind and spirit, and were totally in favor of Hitler and his programs. This included a high proportion of the upper classes, industrialists, etc. They were at least as interested in Germany as in their own profits, and therefore, in Hitler's view, still were part of the nation. They were not exploiters or usurers, but merely successful businessmen who got where they were honestly. But to a rabble-rouser or a Red, they too are capitalists. It never occurs to the masses of people that the real ugly capitalist is our declared enemy. The situations in Germany 50 years ago and in the United States today are vastly different regarding the composition of the ruling classes. It is a safe generalization to state that the ruling class in America has sold out and has got to go all the way. That much, at least, the white workers are fast becoming aware of. Hell, things were so comparatively healthy in Weimar Germany as opposed to what they are here that Hitler was fully able to work within the framework of that system and win. No way in hell we can do that here today. We cannot allow the white worker to believe that we are the friend of the system. The best and only way to combat and reverse this is to preach revolution, revolution, and more revolution. Smash the system. We must develop and bring into focus our socialist programs for a new society. This means a break with right-wingism. If we fail in this, we could lose. That was Volume 9, Number 6, October 1980. 3.8. Terms such as these. Terms such as these. What was that about the kettle calling the pot black? This country, and in particular this system, have been good at name-calling all throughout this century and even further back. The word is self-righteous. Unless a foreign state is an outright vassal of this one, then it is no damned good. And from that point they grade up the scale to full-blown enemies, evil empires, etc. This or that dictatorship, tyranny, all these in quotes, fascist state, and on and on. Never mind the circumstances in that nation or in that part of the world. Never mind that a particular state of affairs may be the only one possible, with the alternative being chaos. Never mind the mood or the will of that particular people. If it isn't, quote, democracy, unquote, then it's got to go. You've seen and heard it 1,000 times. But as a kid in school, I recall what they were trying to teach us that passed for, quote, history, and I remember that they had a special epithet they were fond of applying to Germany's ally in the First World War, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, quote, a vast, far-flung, ramshackle, polyglot empire. This is no defense of the Austrian Empire, as Hitler himself violently and bitterly hated what it was and what it stood for, a multiracial national amalgam. It did, however, serve the purpose of creating and maintaining peace and order in Central Europe and the Balkans until it collapsed in the First World War, and was subsequently dismantled by the, quote, democratic allies. If a man fresh from Mars were to take an objective look at the world situation as it exists today, with no knowledge or awareness of the long-since-disappeared Austrian Empire, and would read a term like, quote, vast, far-flung, polyglot empire, to what country might he attach the description now? Maybe the Soviet Union, maybe several others, but certainly the United States would have to qualify as candidate number one, upon whose foot that onerous shoe would snugly fit. From ridiculing and deriding a political state created out of dire necessity over centuries of terrible wars, and playing a major hand in the destruction of that state, the United States itself has become just such a similar entity. All that it, and he's writing this in, you know, the 80s, before there's been this massive invasion we've seen. He's writing basically 20 years after the 65 Act, and we're now another 20 plus years. He's halfway between us in 2017 and the 65 Act, and even then he could see that it was filling with all kinds of non-white garbage people and becoming a polyglot empire itself. From ridiculing and deriding a political state created out of a dire necessity over centuries of terrible wars, and playing a major hand in the destruction of that state, the United States itself has become just such a similar entity. All that is required now is a contemporary catastrophe, an upsetting force like World War I was, and the U.S. will share the identical fate, except things will be much worse. Could the Czechs and Serbs have had as much resentment for the Austrians or for each other as the blacks and Hispanics have for the whites and for one another here today? Could the vote of no confidence, which the ruling House of Habsburg received at the moment of crisis, be as barren as the one this democratic regime is getting even now? Could all the aspects of statecraft have been arranged then in a more ultimately untenable fashion than they are here today? All it took then was a crisis followed by an abdication, and the entire structure fell to pieces. The number of those who are working to engineer such a collapse here, who would welcome such a collapse, or at least not effectively oppose one, far outweighs the number of those who would or could prevent one. Such was not the fate of Germany, which also suffered defeat and abdication. And not so in Russia, where the same thing happened. In Germany, there was one people. In Russia, there existed a fresh centralized government, ready, willing, and able to step in and assume command to prevent disintegration. Here again enters the comparison with the United States. These groups of people here today hate one another, and they all despise the government. But there is no alternate government currently in shape to take over the reins should something unseat the present one. The stage is set. When it is over with, the map will certainly have been changed, and changed to concur with the racial facts of life. And the mapmakers will have little rest until the renewed racial struggle has been concluded, something that may take many years. When stability and peace have finally resumed in these latitudes, we can hope that things won't resemble a map of Europe after World War I, but rather will contain no artificial and divisive boundaries whatsoever, not only from ocean to ocean, but from Panama to the North Pole. That was Volume 15, Number 2, February 1986. 3.9, When as it happens... When as it happens. Tricky, introverted, and myopic comparisons, quote-unquote, between the sick U.S. and Western societies of today and the sick Weimar society of Germany in the 1920s have become some of the favorite standbys of the right wing in this country since the end of the war. Clearly, something isn't exactly gelling. Revolutionaries can see and know the realities of both situations and can't be kidded, nor do they kid themselves. They haven't got the patience. The question that remains is whether a revolutionary movement will arise from out of the older, more reactionary movement that we have known, or whether it will arise literally from out of nowhere, from among those who have had no experience with the tired and dreary old ways of the past. Perhaps what follows will provide some of the answer. Between living in the past, be it either Reconstruction South or Weimar Germany, and harping on a Jewish conspiracy, the traditional movement has no other leg to stand on, ideologically or strategically. What's been happening, and what's still happening as a result, has been the creation of a magnetic force attracting kooks and cranks, producing something that is, and appears for all the world, to be ridiculous, thus making sure that no solid and worthwhile types will be recruited or stay for very long. And winds up by scapegoating its failures rather than engaging in serious and intelligent reevaluation of its overview and position. Latching onto the past as a profession begs for the system and the media to heap all their many smears and epithets onto us, is an open invitation for the system to pass and enforce such things as genocide treaties, etc., and because it pretends to work within the system, to change the system, it leaves room for doubt about those vast numbers of system-entrenched whites, and opens the way for movement people to write Dear Mr. President letters and tell their members to write their congressmen and to frantically urge America to wake up. In reality, it's a dead-end street. One thing we all received in our years with the old movement was a quite thorough education on the Jewish question. It's all quite true. There is and always has been a Jewish conspiracy ever since contact has existed between Jews and Europeans. I will say that no professional revolutionary can hope to be real unless he is fully familiar with each aspect of the Jewish question. It is only part of his basic education. Again, it is but one factor among many, and this is where the movement has been failing for so long. The fact is that what happened to our people and our culture would probably have happened anyway. Maybe not so soon, maybe not so drastically, but it would have happened. Going back to the close of the Renaissance period, the Jews never could have gotten their foot in the door of Western civilization unless something had not already been amiss in the basic structure and outlook of things. One can point an accusing finger at democracy as being responsible for aliens entering into our affairs, but never forget that democracy in practice, in law, is a most recent development. It only came about after the Jews and their allies got the upper hand in government that matters. When the Jews made their entrance upon the scene, they were allowed in by the very leaders themselves, the kings and emperors, the upper classes. For who else had the power and decision-making ability to control this back then, before democracy? The Jews are aiders and abettors in this. They are specialists when it comes to alien corruption, and they are certainly reaping their share of the profits from it all. And though the number of them directly involved in it condemns them by proportion to their total population, the beast system is still basically manned and operated by renegade, sold-out whites. What we are fighting has always been, and will always be, a sickness from within. Blame? The cause and the wellspring for all of this can be located, but it would be a mistake to seek merely to place a blame. It's been going on for too long now. It is too deeply entrenched in today's lives to try to isolate things and individuals. But if we were to identify where it all comes from, what sustains it, and who profits most from it at the expense of the race itself, then where else and who else could we look to other than the ruling upper classes of society? Those that let the Jews in the first place, those that took them to their bosom, those that always set the newest trends for perversion and degeneracy, those that get richer while we get poorer, those who, in their vilest, foulest depths of anti-life numbness, find their final kicks in drugs and consorting with racial aliens, and with their government in one hand and their Hollywood in the other, seek to reduce the rest of the population to their own level of decadence. I might add that their success in this isn't far enough away from completion to merit any discussion of just, quote, how far. The final word in the last comparison between here and now and there and then with regard to Hitler's miracle in Germany would involve a statement made by Albert Speer in later years as he sought to further acquit himself, further glorify himself, and further condemn Hitler in his highly lucrative written and televised accounts of life in the Third Reich. Speer said, quite correctly, that the reason Hitler's rise in Germany was so fast and so certain was because the very best in German society were behind him. This explains why the entire German nation had to be incinerated in the course of the war, why their entire government had to be murdered. It wasn't just a man or a party, it was the whole country, or at least those elements that counted most. And so Hitler's movement was not the kooky, funny thing we see here in America today. It was truly representative of the will of the German people. If you haven't caught on to the secret yet, then I will spell it out for you why any such comparison between then and now is a totally lame one. True, the Weimar society was a sick one. But it was a sickness suddenly and forcibly attached to Germany at the highest levels. The people themselves saw it and hated it, and were ready for Hitler when he made his appearance. In all, Weimar lasted 15 years. Here, the sickness has been coming along, unabated, for at least three generations, and probably more. It's their own baby, and they love it. They wouldn't be parted from it. It's part of Americanism. The sickness is homegrown, and it is from the inside out. What sort of movement would it take to represent the will of the American people today? With some variations, several are already on the scene, and, I might add, none of them remotely resemble anything National Socialist. Then, too, there is no American people, only whites, who, for the most part, have lost all racial pride and identity. But they are only reflections of what their rulers, the upper classes, have made themselves into. In a plutocracy, ruled by the rich, which this is, the wealthy decide and control the mold of society, how the future generations will take shape. And like any god, they can predictably be expected to fashion the people of the future in their own image. Meet the future today as it was envisioned 40 and 50 years ago, and tomorrow. When we speak of the very best, we have no choice but to speak in very real and very practical terms. Yes, racially best, of course, but best when it comes to profession, best when it comes to training and education, best when it actually comes to shouldering and maintaining the country and the economy, best in practice and performance. Those who were the people who supported Hitler, and those were the people who supported Hitler in Germany. But who are they? Where are they? What are they here today? In terms of American and Western societies in the present day, what I describe in the above paragraph, collectively, can only be referred to as pigs of the system and establishment. And there, in a nutshell, you have the chances of repeating what Hitler accomplished in the 1920s and 30s. These people went gladly off to kill Germany. The white upper classes, which, make no mistake, rule this land, have long since been alienated from their own people, their own past. The great struggles and causes of white history are forgotten. Today, these people are merely managers and custodians, albeit damn well paid ones at that. The West is no longer in competition against any coloreds. It has become the white man's burden, run amok. There is no longer any them or us, for all are happy together in democracy, all these in quotes, at least in theory. All is liberalism. All is materialism. Jews are only a minority in this, but they do manage to swim so very well in this open sewer they have helped to create. But the sick whites are vying each to outdo the other in order to catch up and be the most in of the in crowd. We're talking about a very large body of people who have sold out, or, perhaps better put, have burnt out, with no vital signs left. Yet to remove them would be to see the U.S. at an end. Not to remove them will be to see another Africa arise on the North American continent. It is not so much a conspiracy as it is a head being out of touch with its body, but yet striving to make certain that the body becomes as vile and perverse as the head, thus spelling doom for the entire organism. A ruling body with its own peculiar worldview in which they believe, for they are quite sincere. The whites of this country, and indeed most of the West, have been betrayed by their own rotten leaders. Yes, their natural leaders, the nation's elite. That is why no renaissance can be possible here. Only revolution. It must be death to an entire strata of the population, and a new, fresh ruling elite established from the ranks of the natural peasantry or yeomanry, before that too has been eaten away from the inside and nothing remains of it. And that was the end. Volume 15, number 3, March 1986. That's the end of the section on National Socialism. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again soon, and we'll pick up with section 4 of James Mason's Siege.